Oftentimes, it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education at Stanford, and I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And I should clarify that we are sheltering in place due to COVID-19, the pandemic. So I am looking at Dan's wonderful face across the screen, and our guest today will also be Zooming in. So we are not in the studio.
Denise, we are of the community, Pope.
We are of the community,
Dan.
We are
of the community. Now, today we're going to be talking about community schools and the many different flavors and meanings of what that is.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially during COVID-19, I think there are a bunch of people in the United States now who really had no idea all the different things that schools do for kids. And it's become very clear that schools do more than just offer learning, right? One, they're a very important part of childcare, as I think everybody who's trying to work from home is much more appreciative of having a place to send their kids. But they also are food distributors, right? Kids get fed at school. Kids have shelter at school. Schools are the place where kids get Wi-Fi. There's all these pictures now during COVID-19 of schools passing out and trying to figure out how to get their kids connected on Wi-Fi, and teachers sitting in the school parking lot to lead their lessons because that's the only place that they could get Wi-Fi. So I think we really now realize a little bit more how much the schools do for the community.
So also how much schools orchestrate your life.
Oh, my gosh.
The hours, it's with the summer.
Yeah.
Grade banded. So in this small but mighty village that I taught in Alaska, very, very remote. This is right on the Arctic Circle, very dark in January. The Indians there, the Athabascans, were largely nomadic. And then they moved into small villages, often to collect wood to give to the steamships that would come up and down the Yukon. And this was done through religious groups would come up, and they try and establish a church. You know, so one town would have like Russian Catholic, the next town might be Protestant, and so on. After that, schools showed up, and Molly Hooch was a law that was passed in Alaska that said if you have a certain number of kids, there has to be a school there. So in this village I live in, which only had about 150 adults, there's a massive school building. It's the only building in the town that has running water because it's so cold that the water will freeze in pipes. So
wow.
At that school when I was there, which was quite a while ago, the average cost per pupil was $60,000. And this was the heating bill. This was how much it cost to heat this building. So here's a community where suddenly a school shows up and it changes the hours that they suddenly there's a clock. There's a start and there's a stop. There's homework. The school is providing every service. It is a gym, right? It is where parents go to celebrate. You have parties there. You have dances there. It becomes the center of everything except for what the church does, which it maintained ownership of that. So it's quite interesting to see how much the school creates the community. It doesn't just serve the community. It creates the community. It also led to tremendous tensions because the school is bringing in a certain set of values and ambitions for these children that the parents may not share.
They don't want the kids to learn.
Well, they don't know. So I was successful at getting one child to graduate from there and go to college. And,
wow.
And this is not the dream for the parents. You know, it may have changed now.
Yeah.
Now that TV's around and things like that. So, you know, the desired solution was always to get the locals to want to become teachers. So the school could really be of the community, but that was very hard to do if they weren't going to college.
I know. So were any of them teachers with you at the school?
There was one. She was very good. But you know, again, if they don't go to college, they can't become teachers. So that was high priority. But anyway, the thing that was just striking was there was a case where it was just so easy to see how much the school provides and orchestrates for the community, you know, and I think a lot of people now are beginning to realize just they sort of knew implicitly that the school did a lot, but suddenly it's like, oh my God, the fields are closed. Where am I going with my kids?
Right.
You know, just little things like that.
Absolutely. And how much everyone misses the teachers and how much everyone misses. Sometimes this is your source of friends. When you're dropping kids off at school, you see your, you know, mom friends or your dad friends. And it's definitely taken a toll that kids are home and that we're doing remote learning. But we are lucky because we have today an expert on schools and communities. We have Milbrey McLaughlin, a professor emeritus of education here at Stanford. Milbrey has, among many things, founded the John Gardner Center for Youth in Their Communities back in 2000, and it's still going strong today. She has a May 2020 book out this month, among many of Milbrey's excellent books. I urge you to look them up. This one is called The Way We Do School, The Making of Oakland's Full-Service Community School District. So, Milbrey, we are thrilled to have you. I think this is your first time on the show, so welcome.
It is. I'm almost a Zoom virgin.
That's exciting.
Oh, my God. I'm not going to say a word.
No, Dan, this is SiriusXM, and you can, but we'd rather you not. So, okay. So, Milbrey, we have a question for you. What, you know, that you're talking about Oakland's full-service community school district. I don't think people know the term community school. What is a community school? Are there different types of community school? This is a thing. What does it mean?
It is a thing, and I first got interested in community schools early 80s, mid-80s, when Joy Dreyfus and Jane Quinn and others began to put forth community schools. And the motivating sort of factor really was, I think as you were saying, Dan, schools can't do it alone. And especially in high poverty urban areas, schools need partners to be able to do this. And that was married with what then, I don't know what it's called now, a whole child approach. So if schools can't do it alone, what are the other partners or part of a young person's life that need to be part of a community school? So for every community school, that's the general motivation. That it's more than school and it needs to involve social services and health and other kinds of partners. But within that, there's just enormous variation.
Milbrey, I'm processing what you said. So what you just described is a full service community of which a school is a part.
Right? No, I did not.
Okay.
I didn't intend to.
you probably did not.
That's where I'm going. And I have a very clear argument to make about what the best institutional context is for a community school. But it's a school that extends beyond academics in terms of what schools do, especially for low-income urban kids. And it came from Institution for Educational Leadership, et cetera, just groups of folks and scholars and activists who worked with poor kids. And what can we do to help them do better in school? So it's more than just school. It's more than teaching in more or different ways. In the 1990s, there were probably 5,000 of these schools around the country. I mean, they were scattered around. Most of them were one-offs, or I call it the bright light model. Here's our community school that's doing really well. And there's nothing about the surrounding system that affects it at all. So the institutional context is different. Another way in which they differ is who's in charge, who's the main leader of the community school. Oakland, which we'll talk about at some point, remains the only full-service district in the country that does community schools. New York has a bunch of them, Austin, Nashville, Cincinnati, et cetera, but in none of those cases, is the district in charge, fully in charge. Often it's a community-based organization, United Way, sometimes it's a university. In the case of New York City, it was really the mayor who pushed the district to have these, but there's not a district system around them. They're a school that supports an array of needs for low in, mainly low income kids. Is that, does it make it clearer?
Yeah, I think so. Just a bit, the community, the full service community schools are mobilizing other resources in the community, but the school is the primary place of delivery of those resources.
Correct. Okay. And just to say how Oakland differs in this regard, I think the, well, at least until recently, the typical community school had what was called a co-location model. So the partners who were partners with the schools would come after school and offer mentor, you know, mentoring, sports, health, health services, et cetera. But there was very little, if any, integration between what happened during school and what happened after school. Oakland's model is stands in really direct contrast to that. Tony Smith, who was the superintendent who began it, said the partners come from a youth sector. So the, he had a different denominator. The denominator was health, physical stuff, social services, and education. So all of these folks come together on a campus. And Oakland has taken very aggressive policies to make sure that these partners they have standards, they have leadership issues, there's support from the district, et cetera, et cetera. So that's an, a key piece of the district system that, that supports schools. And they now have around 250 community partners that again, range across the youth sector.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Mowbray McLaughlin about community schools, and in particular, the Oakland School District, which is unique, it sounds like, that all the schools in the district are actually working with the community, a part of the community. So where some schools in some cities might have a mobile dental office, let's say, come after school, or some medical services being offered or sports being offered, it sounds like Oakland as a district really got their act together to do every school in this way. How did that come about? I mean, Tony got an idea, right? The superintendent got an idea. But how do you really make that happen, Mowbray?
Well, I mean, he said from the beginning, all means all. It's not opt in, opt out. So every school in this district will have, to a greater or lesser degree, components of a community school. And right this moment, they have about half of their schools have a full service community school manager, et cetera, et cetera. But every school has elements of a community school, such as a coordination of services team, social emotional learning supports, learning communities, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where the title of the book came from, because the more I asked people about, you know, you've got all these leadership changes, you've got huge problems, you know, what is the stability and future of community schools in Oakland? And the response I got again and again was, that's the way we do school. It's really become part of their DNA.
So let me continue to make sure I understand. So now what I see here is there's a school district that is serving a tremendous convening and coordination function to get all these different providers and resources available to the students. And there's a bit, I don't know if it's command and control, but there's definitely some organization. Are there other, if that is correct, my next question is, are there other things, like do they tailor instruction to the needs of the community? Do they provide special programming based on a community, say, not in the school, but in the evening, for example?
Mm-hmm. The answer is yes to both. But let me start with your command and control question, your point, because, again, Tony Smith was very clear that this will not be command and control. This is another answer to your question, Denise, which is they had a 9-month planning period that involved what they would call the grassroots as well as the grass tops. So over 3,500 folks were involved in this planning. Some of them are our alums, actually, our community alums, Gary Gee, who is on the school board. But the result of that is a very well-articulated implementation approach at both the central office and the site level that folks have bought into. So even through, Oakland has had 5 superintendents in 8 years. So even through that kind of leadership turnover, the plan remains in place. And part of Tony's vision, this is now back to you, Dan, was this is not going to be top down, you know, command and control. It's going to be top-down support for bottom-up change, which is what that planning was all about. And I think that's what explains the stability of this program over time. So the change at the system change at the district office involved the invention of a whole new department. It's called Community Schools and Student Services. So they united all of the various unaffiliated pieces across the district in one department. They have coaching that goes down to the school level. The partnership stuff works through there. The leadership network works through there. So all of the sort of system level resources are both united and also connected to the school level in a very direct way.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Milbrey McLaughlin, who's written a book about Oakland's full-service community school district. And so, Milbrey, if I'm a parent or a kid in one of the Oakland schools, what is going to seem different to me? What do I get that kids outside of Oakland don't get? Let's be really concrete. I'm not sure people quite get it yet.
Well, some of this is specific to Oakland. And the first thing is, as a parent, what you get, and this is a topic I've been interested in well before Dan was in Alaska, which is the whole issue of parent engagement and family engagement. And it was pretty low. It was awful in Oakland. So one of the things they did right at the beginning was revise the whole family engagement model. And I have never seen anything like what's in place in Oakland in terms of genuine, authentic, respectful family engagement in what the school should look like and what the district should look like. So, and this is going to connect to the COVID point as well. So the family engagement would feel very different to you. It's not your mother's PTA. I mean, it's very concrete. As a student, what you'd experience is really this whole child support of partners and an integrated, Oakland has integrated their partners' resources with what happens in classrooms. And often critics of community schools will say, well, yeah, that just dilutes the instructional time. So you're pushing against what your goals are in terms of improving student achievement. But Oakland educators would say, no, it's just the opposite. Because I have these partners and because I collaborate with them, I actually have more learning time than I had before. And the out-of-school time becomes extended learning time. And what we heard again and again was site-level folk don't distinguish between in-school and out-of-school. So this supports both the health-related and other kinds of partner contributions, as well as what goes on in classrooms.
So in a classroom, I'm an outside partner. I want to do social-emotional learning. I come in and I teach a lesson, or I teach the teachers how to teach a lesson on that, or how do you get in the classroom with these community partnerships?
The community partners work after normal school hours, unless they're part of the coordination of services team, which is a group. Every school has one of these. It includes social workers, medical people, families, and they worry about things as much as such as somebody's availability of a size 7 sneaker. I remember sitting in a conversation about that, as well as mental health and other kinds of supports or safety at home. So you get in a classroom by collaborating with a partner. You get into a classroom through the community schools and student services supports that are at the district level. They do phenomenal community learning, professional learning communities that put partners and site level folks on the same page in terms of things like SEL or restorative justice practices.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We've been talking with Milbrey McLaughlin about community schools and all that they have to offer. If if you are in need of health services, if you're in need of social emotional learning, if you are in need of housing and housing issues, social workers, medical care, really the whole kit and caboodle. We'll be back with more with Milbury next on SiriusXM.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So it is hard to predict what the future will be.
The focus is really on academics.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Milbury McLaughlin about something called community schools. And in particular, Milbury's book where she looked at Oakland's full-service community school district. Every school in the district is somehow related to community, a part of working with social services, et cetera. So it's exciting stuff.
So Milbury, I've been trying to think of where the benefits of this are going to show up. And as a school, we've been looking at developing initiatives in special needs, early childhood, and equity, issues, English language learners. And what I've noticed is the greatest vulnerability for children who are just not kind of vanilla, excuse me for using that, is the handoff from one institution to another, right, from the pediatrician to the school. So my prediction, if you coordinate all these things, is the big gain is you're preventing attrition, that you're keeping more people in the game. And that would be my prediction. So the answer is
yes.
Yay.
And it's a complicated answer because remember, this started in 2011 and it started at all three levels of schools. So elementary, middle, and high school. And you didn't see much happen at the high school level, maybe a little at the middle, but it grew up through. So it is a really developmental perspective. So here are the answers to your question after 9 years, 10 years. Decreased suspensions, decreased dropout rates, increased access to healthcare. Last year, for example, 36,000 students, this is back to your integration kind of thing, had visits. Academic achievement, they still have a way to go, but they now have 37% of their kids reading at or above grade level. And this is a community in which 50% of the kids do not speak English at home. And 90% are free and reduced lunch. So that's really something. And in schools that have, again, the really strong parent engagement and a parent focus on staying in school and graduating, Oakland high schools in the Flatlands are graduating 95% of their students.
Wow.
It's stunning. And in two of them, almost everyone went on to college, went on to post-secondary.
Wow.
So it's
hard. How about teachers? Do you know, are teachers burning out or are they staying
in
the system?
Well, Oakland, one thing, the Oakland context makes this success even more remarkable because Oakland has the lowest teacher salaries in the Bay Area. So they tend to get teachers who, circle in and out, and the least experienced teachers tend to teach in the flatland schools, which is, African-American primarily. And they stay for a year or two until they get an offer that pays a little bit better. And Oakland's changed institutional context has really contributed to teachers staying with it. And I would argue that the community school managers in the neediest schools have made a huge difference to teacher commitment.
Right. Right.
It's exciting. I mean, it's how hard is this to get other schools and other districts to take notice? That's just a question. Do you need a lot of money? Are they more expensive to run?
I don't know if we have time to talk about this because this has really taught me a lot about philanthropy. And at first I thought, oh my goodness, they have 20% of their budget is from private funding or, grants and aid. Kaiser, for example, has put in $43 million. What does it say about stability? Everything I know about plan change in education says that can't be a good thing. But I've really changed my mind. I'm absolutely turned around on that. The consistency and the predictability and the commitment of these partners has been huge. That's one thing in the context of all of Oakland's budget mess.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Milbrae McLaughlin about community schools in Oakland and the fact that they had partners like Kaiser and others really helped them just step right up during remote learning and COVID-19.
So I'm listening to this. I've decided that I need to build a full service community school because I've seen how important schools are for serving the community and how much the community needs to support the schools. So I'm ready to get started. What is the big watch out that you want to warn me about as I rev up to
That's great.
Sort of the new future?
Well, this comes from my Oakland experience, and it's watch out that you include the system context, and don't go for the bright light model. And the thing that I've learned, probably the clearest lesson from Oakland, is that without that, you really can't take up equity issues, because in this kind of context and poverty, kids who are in schools that aren't your school have the same sets of issues. So unless it's the larger system change issue. So that would be the watch out.
So hang on. I'm a novice at this and I'm just learning. And so you tell me, take into account the systems context, and I try and figure out where's the system, who's the system, what is the systems context?
So there are two levels of the system, right? I mean, one is the central office, what happens downtown. What are the goals? What are the plans? What are the relationships with the sites? And the second level of the system is at the site level. And I think in Oakland, you would see that the greatest changes happen at the site level. And you can connect it back to what's happened at the central office. But the schools themselves, especially the mature ones, have been transformed in ways that support these kids and their families. Oakland has absolutely frightening budget prospects at the moment, but everyone is committed to the community school model. So you might imagine in another setting that will be the first to go. Who's going to pay for a community school manager? And of the 45 schools that have community school managers, the latest schools coming on, the schools themselves have paid for them. And so this has been a principal's choice of, this is what I need to do.
Yeah, that's a good testament to value.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, Milbrae. Well, thank you so much. I feel like we learned something really exciting and new, a possible model to consider, especially during COVID-19, as people are really thinking about the whole child and what we need to get back up and running and how much the schools do. So thank you. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.